broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
I'm Dulcinea.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Hallie Hawkins speaking on climate action and the Green New Deal. Then we will hear from organizers and volunteers of the Community Partnership Mass Food Distribution event. Later on, in honor of National Faith and HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, there will be a sacred time and space event. After that, for Election Watch 2021, Rodney Wiltshire tells us why he is seeking a term on the Rensselaer County Legislature representing District 1. And finally, we listen in on some of the proposed design for Troy's Monument Square. But first, here are the headlines.
A judge ruled that New York City can proceed with a mandate requiring all teachers and school staff to get vaccinated against COVID-19, saying that unions' arguments against the order simply does not pass the smell test, quote unquote. Meanwhile, an upstate judge has extended a temporary ban on the state's ability to enforce vaccine mandates for healthcare workers seeking religious exemptions. However, private employers can still enforce such a mandate. Negotiations continue on the mandate continue between the state and various labor unions.
As part of the effort to bolster protection for the most vulnerable Americans against the Delta variant, the Food and Drug Administration authorized a Pfizer BioNTech coronavirus booster shot for people 65 and older and adults at risk of severe illness.
A lawsuit filed in federal court against Schenectady County and the county sheriff asserts that a jail guard beat a man being detained at the jail last winter by kicking him in the chest and repeatedly striking him all over his body for the sole purpose of injuring him. The supervisor on duty also failed to intercede to try to stop the attack. Both have since been fired. It appears that the inmate should not have been at the jail after he was released by a judge following a hearing.
Rensselaer County is expanding the area for testing wells for PFOA contamination to the south and east of Algonquin Middle School. The water at the school and at several nearby houses have tested above the state's limits. A community meeting will be held at 7 p.m. Monday at the Post and Kill VFW at 25 Veterans Street to discuss the situation.
New York State has stopped paying legal bills for state employees who worked for former Governor Cuomo as he faced ongoing investigations on the state and federal level.
And as the world moves quickly towards climate collapse, the town of Duanesburg is holding a public hearing on whether it should implement a one-year moratorium on solar energy systems, including battery energy storage systems.
Howard Zucker, the embattled New York Health Commissioner, has submitted his resignation, but will stay on until a successor is named Zucker. Zucker mishandled the Hoosick Falls PFOA water contamination, as well as the COVID-19 crisis, including working with Governor Cuomo to hide the number of deaths, particularly at nursing homes. That's it for headlines. Hallie Hawkins, our first interview, was the first candidate to call for a Green New Deal in his 2010 Green Party campaign for the governor of New York. He evaluates the present climate change proposals pending in Congress and discusses the need for an eco-socialist solution. Mark Dunley brings us this report.
We're joined by Hallie Hawkins, a longtime Green Party activist, 2020 Green Party candidate for president of the United States, several times candidate for governor of New York. In your 2010 campaign, you were the first, at least, you know, political candidate in the United States to have raised the concept of a Green New Deal, which has been adopted in a watered down version by the Democrats. We are now in the midst of negotiations in the Congress over a $3.5 trillion so-called green economic stimulus, which includes a fair amount of money, more than we've ever seen, for climate action. And there are various proposals for, a Green New Deal for schools and a Green New Deal for housing. How are the Democrats really coming in terms of, your vision for what a Green New Deal should be?
Well, first of all, the Democrats as a whole have rejected the Green New Deal. Biden ran away from it. There are progressive Democrats that were talking about it, but that's the non-binding resolution that Senator Ed Markey and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put into the Congress at the beginning of 2019. And that was radically watered down. They eliminated the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure, the phase out of nuclear power, the deep cuts in military spending to help pay for it, and extended the deadline for zero emissions from 2030 to 2050, which is too late. So it was non-binding. So it really wasn't serious. And then Biden ran away from it. So what we have now in this reconciliation infrastructure bill is a lot of social, infrastructure, so-called care economy, pre-K, childcare, community colleges, publicly funded and affordable. There's very little for climate. When Biden put in his original proposal, American Jobs Plan, there's really only about $100 billion a year for 8 years on climate. The Green New Deal that I ran on was about $2.7 trillion per year over 10 years to really get to 100% clean energy in a decade by 2030.
Right. So I mean, that's true. But, Schumer in particular has been pushing this $3.5 trillion package, which is what he is more focused upon. That does have more money for climate, though considerably less than what you were talking about.
Well, we haven't seen numbers. We've seen some speculation. But if it's half of what Biden was asking for, and he was only asking for $100 billion per year directly on climate programs, there's not going to be much in this thing, because most of the money is going to the care economy in this reconciliation package. So I consider it a token gesture on climate action, not a real program.
Well, one of the proposals, partly because they had to deal with the reconciliation limits on how you shape a bill to avoid the filibuster, is, rather than mandating that, say, as they do in New York, utility companies by a certain date get 50% of their energy from clean renewable energy, they're now, come up with a system of sort of paying utilities to increase the amount of their renewable energy. Are there timelines, are there approaches in terms of reducing emission, promoting renewables adequate?
I don't think so. Plus, this so-called clean energy payment program includes forms of energy that are not clean, burning biogas off of factory farms, waste incinerators, nuclear power, burning fossil fuels with so-called carbon capture and sequestration, which is a whole infrastructure they don't have and it's not economical. So how much carbon reduction will even come with this program remains to be seen.
Now, one of the points that you make is, besides promoting a Green New Deal, trying to get 100% renewable energy, zero emissions by 2030, there's also an eco-socialist Green New Deal, which really talks about both more democratic planning and ownership of the energy system, but also the greater, manufacturing system. What do you mean by an eco-socialist Green New Deal?
What's proposed by Biden and even the progressive Democrats is tax breaks, subsidies, and contracts to the same corporations that have got us into this climate crisis. And the problem there is they are not going to invest in replacing what they have until they wear out what they have. So it's going to slow the whole process down. Plus, it will not be coordinated, like between building green housing, public housing, and mass transit. So you create walkable communities that are more energy and resource efficient. That kind of coordination doesn't happen when you're just handing out tax subsidies and contracts. We want to do like we did during World War II, when the federal government took over a quarter of manufacturing to turn industry on a dime into arsenal of democracy to defeat the Axis powers. It needs public ownership and planning to get this done on a rapid time scale. So that's what we mean by eco-socialist. We need a public energy system. We need public broadband. We need in manufacturing to rebuild our manufacturing on a zero waste, clean power basis, so we can manufacture the clean energy equipment for other factories as well as the power production sector. So it requires public ownership and planning. And that's why we're calling it for an eco-socialist Green New Deal to really get the job done.
In reality, can a capitalist economy actually solve the climate crisis? And, you know, has the mainstream climate movement been willing to address this particular question?
No, the mainstream movement has not. Capitalism is a system of limitless, endless growth. Every firm has to grow or die in market competition. So it imparts a dynamic of growth when what we really need is to produce to meet our basic needs within ecological limits. And capitalism just cuts against that by its very nature. So we need a eco-socialist economy where we can plan to meet everybody's basic needs within ecological limits. We need a system change to stop climate change.
As I mentioned earlier, you know, there have been proposals for, you know, a Green New Deal for housing. I believe Senator Sanders has proposed that. And I believe Congressman Bowman, southern part of New York State, has proposed a Green New Deal for schools. What's your sort of assessment of those two proposals?
Well, the housing proposal is good as far as it goes, but it only goes as far as repairing and retrofitting existing housing. That's the Sanders AOC bill. The Bowman bill is about upgrading schools in a lot of respects, including for energy efficiency and conservation and powering them by clean energy instead of, you know, heating with gas. So it's a good bill, deals with one sector. In housing, we got to go further, I believe, because we have a housing crisis, affordable housing. The Green New Deal that I ran on in 2020 called for building over 10 years, 25 million units of new public housing, as well as retrofitting the existing stock of public housing. And that would create enough affordable options that everybody would have one. I think those two bills are good as far as they go. We need to go further. The problem is they're going nowhere in the Congress. It's not part of, you know, this reconciliation bill. They are nice bills that are in committee, but they're not going anywhere with the current Congress that we got.
One thing that at least New York and frankly, a lot of the National Democrats have been talking about is making sure that when we deal with climate action, we have to invest, you know, in environmental justice and helping the victims most harmed by climate change. Is that really enough at this point in the last minute?
Well, environmental justice is a huge issue. Environmental racism is alive and well. Fossil fuel industry keep locating polluting industries, as well as, fossil fuel industry, Cancer Alley in Louisiana. People of color, particularly Black people and Indigenous people with the pipelines up north are being targeted for these polluting industries that harm those communities. And while the environmental justice movement's been around since the 1980s as a, you know, self-conscious movement, the victories are far and few between. So that's a huge issue. And the federal government has had since the Clinton administration an environmental justice office, an EPA, but the inspector general said in his report on it, it wasn't doing anything. And any Green New Deal has to address that by making sure that these communities that suffer from disproportionate impact of pollution from the energy and other industries get remedies.
We've been talking with Howie Hawkins, a Green Party activist, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Mark Dunley also interviewed Howie Hawkins about the Freedom to Vote Act, which aired earlier this week. You can find that segment on our website, mediasanctuary.org. And on September 22nd, 2021, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Community Partnership Mass Food Distribution at Lansingborough Boys and Girls Club in Troy, New York. Catholic Charities and the Capital District Area Labor Federation sponsored the event. In this labor segment, you will hear his interview with organizers and volunteers.
Willie Terry, a Roman labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. I'm here on a cloudy day in Troy at the Community Partnership Mass Food Distribution. And it's at Lansingburg Boys and Girls Club in Troy. Being sponsored by labor and the community, Catholic Charity Outreach, Capital District Area Labor Federation. And also there's a lot of RPI students out here who came out at 8:15 morning to volunteer. It's dripping a little rain, but hopefully the rain hold up until the food distribution is all over. All right, the cars are now rolling in. And they got a lot of fresh, healthy food. Low-fat milk, chicken, corn, cereal, and fish. And I have as my guest Mary Pat Donnelly, who is the district attorney for Rensselaer County. And she's been out here on the line volunteering, packing food. And how you doing, Pat?
I'm doing great. How are you?
All right. And Pat, give me your thoughts and feeling on this.
It's such a necessary service, and I think it's really opened our eyes to how much people really need this. We wonder, where were they before? How were they accessing, you know, these much-needed food items? And I guess the question, as I was just discussing with Sister, is where do we go from here as things go forward? How do we make sure that we're still getting this out into the community? So I am glad that I can help, but it's also very concerning that this level of assistance is still needed. And those of us like you and I who've been to so many of these pantries know that we almost run out of food every single time.
Right. And Pat, with the COVID situation, we don't know what's going to happen. So you think these things are necessary to keep going?
Absolutely. I think COVID is ever-changing. So we don't really know what's in front of us for this winter, this flu season. So you're going to see people who can't work, people who are going to lose their jobs, more people who are going to lose their jobs, people who can't get out to get the food. So this ability to put it in their car in a safe way, I think, is huge for a lot of people.
All right, Pat, thank you for those comments.
Happy to talk to you.
No problem.
And happy to help.
All right, and we'll talk again.
Absolutely. Take care.
Take care.
Good to see you.
And I'm here with my guest. I got Mark Emanation, who's a organizer for the Capital District Area Labor Federation, and one of the key organizers with this community group for this food distribution. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great, Willie. How are you? Thanks for coming out today and volunteering, and thank you for covering this.
Well, Mark, thank you for doing this. I mean, it's a mass effort, right?
It's a big effort. Last year, in 2020, between the end of March and the end of December, we fed 127,000 people. As of Monday of this week, we are over 200,000 this year. So the need is still there. Prices have gone through the roof for food, but for gasoline, for housing, medical, all that stuff. And people, everything but wages have gone up. So as long as people need this, we're going to do it. It's great that we can do it. Look at the amount of volunteers here today. But it makes me angry that we have to do it because we're in the richest country in the history of the world.
Right. And Mark, you're a part of the labor movement.
Yes.
So what are some of the other labor groups that are here?
So today we have Teamsters, mm-hmm. we have teachers, we have nurses, we have electricians, and we have letter carriers and United Food and Commercial Workers, representatives from the Troy Labor Council and from the Capital District Area Labor Federation, and then we have you.
Right. Oh, okay.
Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, and you're retired from...
Oh, yeah, I'm retired, but I'm still here.
You're still here. But CSEA, right? You were CSEA? Yes.
Right.
Yes, so then there we go.
Mm-hmm. So Mark, so what other area will you be having these food drives in?
So tomorrow... We're at the Macedonia Baptist Church in Albany. And then we have two next week. And right off the top of my head, I don't know. We have, but I will send it out to everybody. We have 12 in October. We're planning November now. And we're averaging 12 to 15 a month that we're doing. And we're doing them all over the place. Next week, they're going to Sydney in Delaware County. I'm not going to go to that, but they're doing that. And we're covering the 11 counties that the Labor Federation's in, and we've done them in every county that we have except for Hamilton. So we're hoping we can get up to Hamilton. Hamilton's a huge county, but not a lot of people live there. So we're not sure where to do it, but we've done it everywhere else. Warren, Washington, Essex, Montgomery, Fulton, Schoharie, Schenectady, Albany, and Rensselaer counties. We've hit all of those places.
Right. And Mark, how important it is that labels do things like this? And what's been some of the feedback from people?
So, if labor's purpose is to organize and take care of and help the lives of working people, both poor working people and people that are, you know, in need, but they're fighting for jobs and labor and, you know, good working conditions, all those things, but also the folks that need it like this, labor should do this. And we're doing it all over the country. Here we're doing it remarkably well, I think, because we have this great coalition. Many of the folks in this coalition had never worked with the labor union ever and thought all we cared about was our members. Well, we do care about our members. And about 20% of our members were going to food pantries before the pandemic. But we care about everybody that lives in our communities and our cities, our towns that we're in, the rural areas, everybody. And if human solidarity is what we're trying to do, and that starts with labor solidarity, and the labor movement's got to lead that.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. That's Mark Emanation.
Thank you, Willie.
Organizer for the Capital District Area Labor Federation.
I'll see you soon.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks.
And the calls are coming in, getting the food, and they're coming in one by one. And it's a lot of food. And I have, as my guest, Kim
Lockridge-Hetko.
Lopacheco, right, I forget that name, right? And Kim, the calls are coming in. So Kim, who do you represent?
I represent St. Peter's Health Partners, and the agency that I work for there is Healthy Families of Rensselaer County. So we're
so
part of
why did y'all think it was necessary to get involved in it?
Our agency works with families in Rensselaer County. A lot of our families are right here in Troy and in Lansingburg and, you know, South Troy. We have lots of families that we serve right here in this community. So we really like to try to come out and support these events because we know they serve directly the families that we work with. So we know that it helps them out a lot. Sometimes when I'm done, I will put groceries in my car and take them out to the families that I work with because they can't get here, they don't have transportation or whatever the situation may be. But we do this often. Our agency comes down and helps, you know, three or four times a year. As a group, we come down and we like to help out. So
you think the COVID situation, which is still going on,
yes,
have created a real need.
Yes.
So there's a real need here in Troy.
Absolutely. There's a tremendous need in Troy, especially now that it's time for the kids to go back to school. There's a lot of uncertainty with families, how they're going to get groceries, what happens if schools close down again. And, you know, there's just a lot of uncertainty regarding the whole situation, regarding COVID. It's hard enough to be a parent, you know, and feed a house full of kids, and then you throw a pandemic on top of it, and, you know, that's a recipe for a real disaster. But so that's another reason that we're out here. We know we need to help these families any way that we can. And it's good to see our neighbors. I'm here today. I guess it's RPI day. I'm seeing other people from Rensselaer County, other agencies, other hospital staff, lots of people in the community. So, and I think that's awesome. I think that's just fabulous that we're all out here, you know, doing what we can do. Because,
well,
you know.
Well, food is a problem. I know, and I used to go to the store. What I used to buy for $50 now costs $100.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, this is absolutely true. You know, you could be going to the store and picking up three or four things and coming out $30, $40 later, you're looking in your bag like, what just happened? But that is the state of the world today. So, you know, I know this is very helpful. This is
so
very,
what kind
very
of food
helpful.
Are they giving up?
We've got fresh fruit, fresh vegetables. I see corn. I see bags of russet potatoes. We give out dairy, milk, butter, eggs, cereal. There's meat today. There's a lot of meat today. Lots of different types of chicken products. Sometimes there's like little incidentals like tea and coffee and things like that. So treats for kids, muffins, you know, little gummy bears, things like that. So there's a wide variety. Every time you come to one of these things, the amounts of food is astounding, and the different types of food just is like, I'm like, wow. That's amazing. It's awesome that we get all of this, you know, donated. And that's just amazing. I think it's fantastic.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Kim.
No problem.
And you're from what the agency?
I'm from Healthy Families of Rensselaer County, which is part of St. Peter's Health Partners. Our office is actually in St. Mary's, at the St. Mary's campus. We're on 3 North.
Okay.
So.
All right. Thank you, Kim.
You're welcome. You have a good day.
And that was Willie Terry with coverage on the Community Partnership Mass Food Distribution. This is part one of 3 of the Community Partnership Mass Food Distribution. For those just tuning in, I'm Dulcinea.
And I'm Kathy Silver. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
This program covers stories on social and environmental justice, produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with Kyla Laux, counseling and testing case manager at Albany Med, about the Sacred Time and Space event in honor of National Faith and HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. The virtual event features a discussion on HIV/AIDS, an interfaith prayer led by many different faith tradition leaders, and a space for participants to share their own stories and experiences. The aim is to create a space for folks to process, express, or heal as they need with the support of their community, faith leaders, and sexual wellness experts.
On the phone, we have Kyla Laux. She's a counseling and testing case manager at Albany Med and one of the organizers of a very interesting and unusual event this weekend on Sunday, September 26th. It's called Sacred Time and Space. Welcome aboard, Kyla.
All right. Thank you for having me, Steve.
Sure. Can you tell us a bit about this event?
Yeah, of course. So I work over at Albany Med's HIV Medicine Clinic. So we've collaborated with the Department of Pastoral Care at Albany Med to celebrate National Faith HIV and AIDS Awareness Day. So this is a national day that happens every August. We've decided to move it to September just due to scheduling, and we want to make sure that we're being as intentional and as available as possible for folks. But basically the gist of our kind of get-together is going to be a virtual space in which folks can log on through WebEx or either calling in through a call-in number from 1 p.m. to 2:30 on Sunday, September 26th. And we're going to kind of have a discussion about HIV and AIDS. It marks 40 years since the HIV and AIDS epidemic started. So we're going to have a little background discussion of that. We're also going to have a space for an interfaith prayer. We have some faith leaders from lots of different faith traditions, from Buddhism to paganism to Christianity, and we're inviting everybody to kind of send their intentions in to for everybody to pray together. And then following that, we're going to have an open discussion where we're going to invite participants to share their stories, if they have personal relationships with their journeys with HIV and faith, or how faith has helped them in their journey of health, or even if folks are, this is their first time kind of interacting in the HIV space, to learn something and to ask from other people. Our goal is to create a space that's accessible, which is why we're going to do it virtually, but also a space that's super welcoming for all people, No matter their background, their sexuality, their gender orientation, anything like that, all folks are welcome. So we're super excited. We're also going to be hosting at-home testing kit giveaways during the couple hours. So folks are going to be able to either request to have one sent to them in the mail, or they can pop by the hospital at any time during like 1 to 3. And we're going to give away free at-home testing kits, condoms, safe sex material, and lots of resources.
Is this the first time that Albany Med is doing this?
Yep. So this is our first year, but hopefully it will not be our last.
What is the Department of Pastoral Care at Albany Med, which is the co-sponsor?
Yeah, so the Department of Pastoral Care, so this is my first time working with the lovely folks over there, but it's a wonderful collection of pastors and faith leaders and folks from all sorts of different faith traditions to be there in support for folks in the hospital. So they do a lot of work around leading weekly meditations, visiting patients' bedside, last rites, and helping families kind of talk through whatever kind of illness is going on. And so they were really excited to partner with us because HIV and faith communities do have a long history of working together, and they wanted to kind of rebring that to the light. So we're working with one of the pastors who's been a super wonderful member of our team is Reverend Virginia. And she's been awesome. So she's been helping orchestrate the faith side of everything as we're kind of orchestrating the HIV end.
We're on the phone with Kyla Laux. She's the counseling and testing case manager at Albany Med, talking about an event coming up on Sunday, September 26th, online, Sacred Time and Space. I'm old enough to remember the first year of the AIDS epidemic and just the sheer terror that it unfolded for years in this country and around the world. There are so many stereotypes about who the people were who were most likely to get AIDS, and just everything around it was so mysterious, which I think is, to a large extent, it explains the fear of it. What's changed in 40 years and what hasn't?
Oh, so good question. So HIV stigma is definitely still prevalent, and I think that's something that we're trying to help address with events like this, is a lot of folks, their faith plays a huge role in how they live their lives and how they cope with certain news and things like that. And sometimes, and as we know in the past, a diagnosis of HIV can come with a lot of stigma. There's a lot of misconceptions about how HIV is transmitted, and faith communities can be a place of stigma, or they can be a place of like wonderful warmth and acceptance. So we're just trying to restart that conversation again. And because I do think that, unfortunately, stigma exists. As somebody who does testing every day, I see it. It's really hard sometimes for folks to come in to get tested based on what they think other people will think. But as far as things that have changed, HIV is so different now. Folks can take one pill a day and be healthier than someone who's HIV negative because they're attending their regular doctor appointments. They can become undetectable, which means their viral load has dropped so low that they can't transmit the virus sexually to anyone else. So it's really cool.
Interesting. And does COVID complicate things for people in your line of work combating AIDS?
COVID has, as with everyone, I'm sure, thrown a wrench in the plans. But the biggest thing that we see with our patients and I see day to day is the sheer isolation that COVID has caused. And for a lot of our like long-term survivor folks, you know, a pandemic and an epidemic is not new news to them. And they've already lived through that isolation experience and then having to kind of be thrust back into it again and feeling alone or feeling like all of their resources and the people that they normally connect with aren't there. Can be really hard. So we're doing our best to kind of try to bridge the gap to services and connect people with support groups or host events such as the one on Sunday to give people a space just to hold community and be able to be with somebody else and kind of share their stories or just have a space where they can, you know, feel okay in their skin again.
Well, I've asked you a lot of questions. Is there a question I haven't asked you, something you'd like to say that I haven't thought to bring out?
Not much. We're just, I guess I only want to reiterate again that we're welcoming every person, any person of any faith tradition, any background. If you've had a negative experience with faith and because of your diagnosis, come along. We want to hear about it. We want to be here to share that with you. And if you have, you know, a wonderful experience with how faith has encouraged your life and getting better or taking meds, you know, we're here for that too. So, no, it's great. We're so excited to host this, and we hope that this will happen in, you know, every year moving forward, just to be able to offer folks this space to continue that discussion.
And if people want more information about the event and about these issues, can you direct them?
Yeah, so folks can either reach out through on our Facebook page. So if you go to Albany Med Prep, that's P-R-E-P, it'll have all the information to the event as well as services on HIV and a big link to faithaidsday.com, which is the umbrella organization that has started this wonderful day.
And as far as information about how to join the call?
Yep. So if people want to join in, they can either send me an email, which is my last name, Loux, L-O-U-C-K-S, and then the number 1@mc.edu, or they can give me a call at 518-264-5839, and I'll send the link on over.
Great. So that's this Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 2:30 p.m., an online event called Sacred Time and Space, a virtual space to share, learn, and listen, an interfaith prayer, open story sharing, and a discussion of HIV/AIDS. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Kyla Laux, we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You can find more information about this event for National Faith and HIV/AIDS Awareness Day on our website at mediasanctuary.org. Rodney Wiltshire, former Troy City Council President and two-time mayoral candidate, is seeking a term on the Rensselaer County Legislature representing District 1, which covers Troy. HMM Political and Public Affairs Correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with Rodney about what accomplishments as a public official he's most proud of, his feelings about the Black Lives Matter movement, and where he stands on some of the issues facing Troy.
Rodney, thank you so much for taking a moment to talk to me today.
Glad to be here. Very excited.
You're running for county legislature. Is this the first time you've run for this position?
Yes, it's the first time I've run for county legislature. You know, I was on the Troy City Council for a number of years. I was the council president 4 years ago, and you know, I've run for office multiple times, but this is the first time I'm running to represent Troy on the county level.
I think a lot of our listeners would be curious to know what the county legislature does. Can you explain it?
The county legislature, as it states, is the legislative body of county government, and the executive branch comes up with a budget, a spending plan, specific activities that might want to be done to make better the lives of the residents in the towns and the cities and the communities. And the legislative body approves that. And so we are mostly a behind the scenes voting contingent that approves spending plans by the executive branch.
What are you hearing as you're talking to potential constituents?
So, you know, we're in Troy, we're in the city of Troy, and our issues are different than the issues that might be in a town of Brunswick or Pittstown or North Greenbush. Everybody's got their own backyard problems. So I'm hearing the same things that I've heard, you know, many times as I've run within the city and I've served within the city. The conditions of the city, you know, our city has got a very diverse landscape and diverse population. So there are some absolutely beautiful locations where, you know, nothing ever happens. And then there are areas in the city where the garbage is flying around and buildings are crumbling and there's a lot of crime and poverty. So, you know, we're hearing, please help us, please do something, please help, you know, same things, help us with these potholes, help us with our taxes, help us with services and public safety. We're also hearing that, you know, we need to have representation, you know, throughout the city, especially on the county level, because there are 6 county legislators in the city of Troy. And to be quite honest with you, unless someone's had a personal relationship with one of these elected officials, most of the residents don't know who their legislators are.
Do you support the resolution recently adopted by the Rensselaer County Legislature calling on Governor Hochul to reverse the criminal justice reforms like raise the age and bail reform?
So I think that's a complicated issue in general. I understand the original intent behind it, to be completely honest. I see that, and I think on paper, that law, you know, had some merits and had things that were going good for it. However, you know, as I sit and I've seen the effects of that play out over our community, even more so in Albany, where we've had an opportunity to witness some of the actual effects of it play out, I do at this point think that it needs to be looked at again and also given back discretion to, you know, the judicial system. I think that not all things with good intentions often, you know, make their way through correctly. So, yeah, I guess I do support that resolution as well.
What initiative are you the most proud of in your public service career?
I guess it would be something near and dear to my heart, which was our solar resolution and our ability to have a solar farm installed in the city of Troy and at the closed landfill. So repurposing, you know, an area that really had no other purpose at that point. You can't build on it. And then turning it green to produce renewable energy that has helped offset the bills, the electrical bills, which lowers the taxes in the city of Troy.
Rodney, what does the Black Lives Matter movement mean to you?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of morphed a little bit. You know, I am a person of color. I'm biracial. I'm half black and half white. Intrinsically and internally, I understand what that statement means. And there's truth to that. There's power to that. And, you know, I do believe that there is a movement that occurred that needed to occur to recognize that, you know, Black Lives Matter. There are people that go missing all the time, people who are kidnapped, people who are murdered and killed throughout our country and throughout the world. The ones that make the headlines are typically the people who are not black, but it's the most sensational, the most captivating. It's the ones that, you know, for whatever reason, typically pull on the heartstrings of America. And when you just see things like that over and over again, and you don't see the same kind of attention poured into people of color when tragedies happen on their end, it's, you know, it's just, oh, there's another shooting in Chicago, there's another, you know, family party that something bad happened at, or, you know, there's another, you know, person who was kidnapped and we don't even hear about that, and they're the people of color. That's, I think, where the statement Black Lives Matter and the notion that Black Lives Matter is powerful, and that's where power happens and where it needs to be brought to the front, and it needed to be brought to the front. And I think that, you know, to be quite honest, I think it has effectively been brought to the front. So to me, that's the movement that I support and I stand with and I believe in, and I understand that has been effective. The organization, which I think there has been, I don't know if it, you know, the organization came before or after the statement. It seems like I've heard, you know, Black Lives Matter for, you know, over 10 years and possibly even before that. The organization, some of the things that I've seen happening, the violence, rioting, coordinated rioting, I don't agree with that at all. And I don't stand with that kind of behavior. Activities that don't bring us together but separate us, I think that's a lost cause there. And I think that's a cause going in a different direction than we need as a community, whether it be here in Troy or in America in general.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Rodney Wilcher, who's a candidate for Rensselaer County Legislature in District 1, representing Troy. You're running on three party lines in November. So when voters go to the polls, they'll see you on the Republican Party line, the Conservative line, and the Working Families Party line. When I look at the platform of all of those parties, the values of the Working Families Party and the Conservative Party in particular couldn't be more different. How do you reconcile that?
For me, I've always been someone who stands for the working person. I have been endorsed before by the WFP. I've actually carried the line when I ran for mayor. I was that was my only line that I ran on. Those values, as far as getting paid a fair wage and being respected and dignified for putting in work and hard work and the type of work, those are values that I think most Americans, to be honest with you, can support and agree with. The other lines that exist that are out there, there are conservative values, I think, that many people in the city of Troy also feel. It's not impossible for someone to have multiple opinions on several different subjects. I think we're all very complicated human beings. And even though, you know, our media and our social and our climate today tries to pigeonhole us into one camp one way or the other, what I've found is that we are all not painted with one broad paintbrush of one color, of one stripe. We have multiple identities, if you will, multiple pieces of our identity that exist within us. So, you know, I think it's, you know, an honor, if you will, to be seen by, you know, Republicans and conservatives as not only a viable candidate, but someone that they can get behind and support, that they have an open mind and they have an open eye. And to be quite honest with you, many of the voters in the, you know, Working Families Party have conservative values on other ends of the discussion. So, you know, we're not all in one camp at all time. And I know that some of the political higher ups try to enforce that, you know, like, if you don't agree with this, then you're not part of our group. And it's just not like that. And thank God we live in America where we do have the ability to vote across party lines and vote the way our conscience tells us to, and to pick the person, not the party.
I have five rapid fire questions for you. These are yay or nay questions. Here we go. Legal marijuana dispensaries in Rensselaer County, yay or nay?
Nay.
Proof of vaccination to get into public gathering places like concert venues and sporting events?
Nay.
Crossgates Mall expansion into the Albany Pine Bush area?
I'm going to say nay.
And one Monument Square plan, love it or hate it?
Oh, man. Neither, but I'm going to go more towards loving it because we need to do something. Sorry, that wasn't a one word.
That's a good answer. All right. Well, thank you so much for playing along with the yay or nay.
Yeah.
You did a pretty good job. And thank you so much for talking to me.
All right. Have a great day. Thank you so much for having me on.
This interview is part of HMM's Election Watch 2021 series. Here, Corinne Carey interviews with other candidates on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
In our final segment, on September 8th, the proposed design for Troy's Monument Square was presented to the city. HMM's Andrea Cunliffe brings together excerpts from that event specifically relating to the outdoor space, the plaza, the park, and the riverfront. We hear from representatives of developer Hoboken Brownstown Company and the Troy Local Development Corporation, who are partnering with the City of Troy to redevelop the One Monument Square site, a long vacant waterfront property in downtown Troy.
Troy City officials, representatives from the Hoboken Brownstone Company, and members of their design teams held a town hall meeting on September 8th to present the proposed design for the former City Hall site in downtown Troy, known as Monument Square. The presentation was the latest step in a multi-year process to redevelop the vacant Monument Square property along Troy's newly revitalized downtown waterfront. The design of the building, the plaza, and the public space, and the waterfront connection to Riverside Park signals the developer and the city are prepared to move forward with the redevelopment of a long vacant Hudson Riverfront property. The building on River Street would have a first floor with a bar, restaurant, brewery, lobby, retail space, and a food market space to encourage businesses that would continue to develop from Troy Farmers Waterfront Market or similar venues. The building would have about 90 apartments on the upper floors and a parking garage beneath. There would be a 20,000 square foot plaza that would provide the open space that residents wanted to see at the site, located at the southern end of Riverfront Park. Following are excerpts from that meeting on September 8th.
In the streetscape and the public realm section along River Street, if you think about the southern end of our site, it's the more historic looking streetscape, a ton of brick in the streetscape, a wider sidewalk depth. And then the further you go north, it starts becoming more your traditional kind of modern 8-10 foot wide concrete sidewalk in front of the Arts Center, for instance. And so part of the evolution of the streetscape follows with the evolution of the programming of the building and the design of the building. So out in front of the two-story kind of restaurant space, there's opportunity to engage the outside, you know, have an exterior use complementary to the interior space. And as you move through, the materials and textures are consistent with what's in downtown, but kind of move you progressively north until you get to the plaza space. The plaza space is actually, it's 145 feet of frontage right at the back of the sidewalk along River Street. So that's almost a 50-yard football field. That's a really wide, but this open and inviting public space was really important to us. You know, River Street, we want to transform River Street. We're not totally redoing it, but we're transforming the streetscape there. So we've added a curb bump out section at the intersection that allows us to do traffic calming measures, make that public plaza space feel like it's pulling out into the streetscape and engaging the actual street, and across the street, the monument or the park on the other side, and creating the feel and the reality that there's a wide open, inviting public space to the waterfront. To follow up on this plaza level, there's a couple of key components that I want to kind of walk everybody through. One is, as I mentioned, it's about a half acre size upper level plaza. There is no hard edge at the end of the plaza as it approaches down to the river. There is intentional connection between the two so that there is multiple ways to connect people from the plaza to the public space. We're designing them together as one element. The switchback kind of ramp section, that's the accessible route. Grand staircase that kind of opens up. That's your prominent visual and connective link. There's multiple avenues and ways you can approach and engage the park and the upper plaza area. What do we want the space to be? We want the space to be flexible. We want it to have a series of outdoor room capacities. So there's flexible furniture built in there. Because some days on a great night like tonight, you know, maybe it's just a public space to walk and just have a casual conversation. Maybe there's a festival tomorrow. Maybe that's a whole different use. So that flexibility of space was really kind of key. We have shade tree opportunities, a seating area where swing benches, something as simple as a swing bench on the water is enormously successful. Yeah. The elements of the steps in the middle, these are large granite blocks. So instead of having just a stair, there's a different way to play. There's a different way to move yourself, different way to seat. You can use it as amphitheater. There's a different moment along there. You see the idea of a kiosk. You know, that's a way to engage and activate the plaza through a vendor space.
How you activate the space, a cafe, the Esplanade, this can be in a hugely vibrant space. The playground park is fully integrated with our potential design, and the monumental stair kind of centered on the wharf building. A lot of communities nowadays are doing night movies, and if you hurry out up there, you can catch Jaws 19 on the big screen.
I think just to close our portion of this, how can we use the park? How can we engage people of various, you know, interests? And this is a good example of a way you can engage a group of people. This is a concept. This is just an idea. The importance of this public space and all the different things that it could potentially offer us.
So I want to touch a little bit about the retail programming for this. And I'll start by saying that so far we've been curating these opportunities for the last year and a half. Right now we have no commitments across the board, but we are looking forward to bringing all of these parties to the table as soon as we know we're moving forward with the project. The first thing we did when we really started thinking about the retail program is understanding Troy, what makes Troy so unique and energetic, and what the entrepreneurs of Troy have done to create the booming downtown that you guys see tonight. And we wanted to really focus on the most important critical aspect of downtown Troy and what makes it so vibrant, which is the farmers market. Steve Ridler and his predecessors have done a phenomenal job at creating one of the Northeast's largest farmers market. And how great would it be to have the bookend of the farmers market eventually be at this location where you can just envision where the plaza space and ultimately the vendors start flowing out onto the plaza space and being able to use all of the activation points that Andy mentioned throughout the open space. The idea here, and I am putting a few words into Steve's mouth because this is, I think, a little bit more my concept interjected with his. And the idea here is really about an incubation food market. So taking some of these farmers that have never had a brick and mortar location, giving them an opportunity to have a full-time shop for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And if they're successful, they can go off to have a platform from which to do so and incubate their next retail business and launch their own brick and mortar, ideally here in downtown Troy. So that's something that we're very excited for if that can come to fruition. In all due respects to some of the waterfront restaurants here in Troy, I think the Capital Region as a whole lacks great, vibrant, outdoor, indoor sort of eateries. So the concept here is really about the food, bar, even a brewery concept, where you have outdoor wraparound plaza space, you have access to the indoor outdoors, you almost get the feel with the big open garage door style windows that you're sitting there elevated over the Hudson River, you're looking at the kids on the playground, you're looking at the bikers riding down the walkways, and you really just have a great ambiance that really creates a presence for downtown Troy and really, in my opinion, will bring a lot of people here from all over the Capital Region. The concept is something that we've been working on for, again, a year and a half. It's a consortium that's been put together between RPI, Siemens, the global engineering company, the City of Troy, the LDC, and the Future of Small Cities. There are a few other groups that are part of this, but right now those are the commitments towards this initiative. And really it's a living lab, and the idea is around building technology. It's a showcase location to not only talk and learn, but also have R&D and eventually get into workforce development about how the data attributes that are coming from this building over the course of the construction as well as throughout the process are actually driving decisions that can be analyzed and eventually taught to the next generation of workforce about how building energy, building evolution, building technology is evolving. And I think we have a great consortium that's come together to really help push that envelope. That all said, I will say that we're building it in such a way that it is a unique space, in our opinion, will be highly sought after. So all of these opportunities are, they're available, and we're working towards getting those committed over the next few months. So the goal here tonight is really to get the community to understand and see our vision and buy into the direction of where we're bringing Monument Square, right? That is, and full stop, that is really what we're looking to do here tonight. From there, the onus is on us, and when I say us, it's us, the city, the LDC, and the community, everybody to come together in order to fulfill the vision and the direction that we're going.
Andrea Cunliffe brought us that recap. This is part two of a series about the proposed design for Troy's Monument Square. Well, that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dulcinea Diggs.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Our engineer is Spencer Keeble.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear the local news or to stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.